Thank you. Thanks so much. And welcome, everyone. It's so lovely to be back with you today. I am here pretty much every Mother's Day, it seems, for the past few years. So I feel really fortunate in that way. And I really deeply want to wish all the mothers, in whatever form that you're a mother, a happy Mother's Day. We are going to be talking about the appropriate response. You know, what is an appropriate response? What does that even mean? What is the call that life draws us into? You know, what might block our innate responsiveness? And also really touching into that very capacity that we all have to respond. And that is something that most mothers know deeply. That responsiveness, both sometimes the wrestle with it and the actual deep connection to responding. So whether you're a mother or not, I welcome you today, wherever you are. I always love seeing how people are from all over the world in joining this Sangha. That's really inspiring for me. And I myself am based in Los Angeles in Santa Monica, which is the traditional land of the Tongva people. I've been very grateful to live here for the past 3 years and to be working as a teacher with Insight LA, as well as with a focus on sex and intimacy and desire, those very real Dharma practices for so many of us. So today I'm going to weave this all together in this exploration of appropriate response. But first of all, we're going to sit together like we do in this Sangha, as is our practice, cultivating attention and insight, things that are deeply interwoven into responsiveness. So let's do that. Wherever you're at, take a moment and settle in. Know that the moment, however it's arising in your meditation, is always asking something of you. It's asking for your attention, for your presence. So as you settle in, you can ask yourself, what support do you need in order to receive the moment? You know, this can be an exploration for this whole meditation, but I want to start you off with a little bit of guidance. So, for instance, you can notice your posture. Is more uprightness being called for? Some uprightness that brings alertness? Or maybe it's some more relaxation. Just relaxing in, leaning back an inch so that you can receive the moment. So, taking a moment and dialing in your posture. What is it that's needed so that you can fully be here? Maybe it's an extra cushion. And then recognizing, is it most helpful for me to have my eyes closed to really draw my attention inward? Or maybe I'm quite sleepy, or it's uncomfortable for me to have my eyes closed, and it's helpful to have them open and soft and just looking down towards the ground. So feeling for yourself, being in this living exploration of what's helpful. And as you settle in there, choosing your focus on one point. What is it that helps you concentrate? So it could be the breath at one place in your body, the in-breath and the rise, the out-breath and the relaxation. It may be focusing on sound. Right now, I can hear really beautiful birds singing outside my window. So it could be in receiving the sounds around you. It could be in the general feeling of sitting here in your body, whatever posture you're in. So choosing one that calls to you in this moment and then staying with it for the meditation. Allowing it to act as an anchor, rooting you more deeply in the moment. As you continue to dial in, noticing what more is needed. Maybe it's dropping your shoulders or bringing some curiosity to whatever it is that you're anchored in. Noticing your innate capacity to respond and open to the moment. That's our practice for this next part of our meditation. If your mind wanders or gets distracted, the response is to simply notice that's happened and return to your anchor, the sound, your breath, your body. Return to this moment. And noticing what happens as you bring your responsiveness, as you dial in, as you open, relaxed or alert. What happens to your energy, to your awareness, as you stay in an intimate connection with life, moment to moment? noticing the arising of life in this moment and your response. Receiving the moment as it's arising, bringing that natural responsiveness. At this point in the meditation, if your mind is settled, you can turn your attention towards more subtle waves in the body, maybe more distant sounds, more subtle sensations that are arising. Noticing your attention's ability to attune to these most subtle whispers, and your ability to receive them. In this last minute of the meditation, renewing your intention to bring your awareness, to bring your responsiveness to the moment. Thank you for sitting with me. So welcome. Welcome if you've just joined us during the meditation. It's really lovely to be here with you. My name's Justine Dawson. Like I said, I'm your guide for today in this exploration of responsiveness, what is called the appropriate response. And I want to invite you, if there's anything you want to share from your meditation, that exploration, that living exploration of responding to the moment, please feel free to share it in the chat. And like was mentioned in the beginning, if you have questions that arise as I talk, you can put them in the Ask a Question feature, which is at the bottom of your screen. And then when we get to the Q&A portion in about half an hour, then the questions will be there and we can look at them together. So that responsiveness that you were exploring in your meditation, I invite you to continue it, to bring it with you as I talk of, oh, what does it take to receive this moment, to lean in and explore these ideas? The theme of this talk, the appropriate response, it comes from a koan, a Zen koan. It's called the Blue Cliff Record, case number 14. Sounds very official. And in it, a monk asks the Zen master Yunmen, who's really a master in many of these koans, what is the teaching of a whole lifetime? And Yunmen replies, an appropriate response. So what are the teachings of a whole lifetime of practice and teaching? And he says, an appropriate response. So this feels pretty significant, right? And you might, like me, be drawn to question, well, which appropriate response? What if I pick the wrong one? Or how do I know that I'm actually doing this appropriate response? Maybe you feel that in your meditation and maybe you feel that in life, because isn't that what we experience so much of the time? That feeling of, wow, life is rising up. There's a call and we wonder, what do I do here? You know, what's the right thing? Is there something different I should be doing? Or where's the guidebook? You know, I think many of us turn to spiritual practice for those reasons, for those questions of wanting to know the resonant response, the appropriate response. And one thing I really want to remind us at the very beginning here is that this appropriate response is a koan. And koans, if you're not familiar with them, are really designed to work our analytical mind, to actually kind of exhaust it in a way. They present a question that in some ways is beyond answer, or it's beyond an answer that our analytical mind can come up with. And it really requires a different kind of knowing to arise. And so that's what I'm going to invite us into today, is to connect to that different kind of knowing. It's a knowing we're all capable of. We have this innate capacity. And that's really a gift of our practice, is helping to reveal it. And because it's innate, that means today, at least, I'm not going to be giving you any set of rules to follow. I'm not going to be prescribing formulas to apply so that you can make sure you're really getting the right response, that you're being a good Buddhist. As much as I have loved those in my life, of course, the Buddha has 1,000 lists, so many different instructions. You know, he really loved organizing things that way. And they can be really helpful, all of these different teachings, these approaches. And they can also be helpful as training wheels. They give us a sense of what's possible. They help us align our minds and hearts to open to something. But, you know, as the Buddha taught, once the raft meets the other shore, there's a time where we release it. And for today, at least, I want to explore that. So to explore it, of what is it like to take the training wheels off? What is it like to explore spiritual practice like a spontaneous response to life, in the moment, fresh response to life, where we can meet life's intimacy, its immediacy, and allow the life force to move through us. That life force that's always present, that's always available if we're here to receive it. So I just want to check. I notice here in the chat function that some folks are having a hard time with the screen freezing. So I want to make sure that people are okay with that. Can other people hear me okay? Is it coming through fine for you? Let me know in the chat. So that's all good. Great. Okay. So please let me know if there is further problems, and also we'll be helping you with that. So it's all good. Okay. Thank you. Okay. Great. So, well, let me take this moment then to say a few more words about who I am, because everything that I teach comes from my own personal inquiry, my own wrestling with these koans of life. And of course, I also have the foundation that my teachers have provided me really generously, deeply, as well as the experience I have working with students and clients and really being graced by being intimate with their experiences and getting to learn from them. But for myself, I am a recovering perfectionist. I would say my name is Justine and I'm a recovering perfectionist. Of course, I have many aspects of self, but let's be honest, that's a big one. And I don't take it personally. And really, you shouldn't either. You know, the Buddha taught that our minds are all rife with these poisons. He calls them poisons, or they've been called poisons in the text. I would say that they're patterns, is maybe a word that I like, is that there's especially three predominant patterns that show up. And that is greed, aversion, and delusion. You've probably heard this before, greed, aversion, and delusion. And most of us, you know, most often are especially experts in one of them. You know, for me, that's aversion. It's that's an expression. Perfectionism is an expression of aversion. And this intimacy I have with that state of mind, intimacy from 25 years of insight meditation practice, from a lifetime, 47 years of really getting to know this aspect of mind. Whatever age you have, you know, you have all of those years of getting to know your aspects of mind, whether directly or indirectly. And for me, I know the suffering of aversion deeply and how it's blocked my own access to responsiveness. Now, like I said, fortunately, I'm also a 25-year practitioner of insight meditation. And the Buddha's teachings on seeing the true nature of mind, the true potential of our being, have informed me deeply. And so I haven't had to stay trapped inside of that aversive quality. It's something I know I can work with. And as well, you know, for 15 years, I've deeply studied intimacy and embodiment, being rooted to something that's below the rational and linear mind. And so today I'm going to be drawing on both of those perspectives to talk about how we can navigate these patterns that we have and access this truly natural innate responsiveness. It was actually a direct experience that I had recently that inspired me to think about talking about this today, because whenever any teacher gives a Sangha live talk, it's very open of what we're going to talk about. And I chose this one because when it came time for me to think of my theme, it was spring was coming here in Los Angeles, and it was a couple of months ago. And it was also the time when the pandemic was shifting, for me at least, you know, after 2 years of being relatively isolated, you know, staying within, you know, sort of more of the blocks of my neighborhood, spending a lot of time inside of these walls of my apartment, here on Zoom. Well, usually it's Zoom for me when I'm here on my laptop meeting with clients and students from all over the world. You know, I could travel that way. But besides that, here I was. And what happened was a couple of months ago, I could feel it was time for change. You know, it was time to go beyond those confines that had become somewhat cozy, even if they were suffocating at times. And it wasn't like one specific action. You know, there were some like, time to exercise. Maybe some of you have gotten that one. But it was also a general feeling like life was starting to call and say, hey, it's time to move into something different. Maybe you've experienced this too recently, maybe because of the pandemic or because of other things, but essentially you're in this reality that's habituated. It's something that you're used to, whether you were used to it in the beginning or you've grown used to it. It's familiar, maybe comfortable, and then a call comes. And that call can take many forms. So you could read the news. You could get into conflict with a family member. Maybe your boss sends you an email. Or like me, maybe it's more like you feel the pulse of life, like something comes through and you know something is being asked of you. A response is being asked of you. There's an invitation to a kind of change that's coming through. And I'm talking about these calls. You know, the talk is about the response, but I'm talking about these calls because they're the root. You know, in order to have an appropriate response, we must be able to hear the call. If we can't hear the call, we can't know what the response is. We can't respond. And sometimes, like I said, that call will be quite obvious. You know, it will be like, wow, that was dramatic. But sometimes it requires a deeper attention. You know, that's why in the meditation, I was inviting us to start tuning into the more subtle waves, because calls can often begin like a whisper faintly. It's like a hum in the background. Or maybe it's an image in a dream, or kind of like a sensation, an itch in the body. But whatever it is, it's our practice to attune so we can hear it. And that's why we practice our attention. That's why we learn to cultivate it. At least it's one of the reasons. So we can dial in and we can sense the call as it's arising. So right now you might even want to take a moment and reflect and turn your attention towards your own life. And what calls have been coming to you? Again, maybe they're quite obvious, like, oh yeah, there's that thing I need to deal with. Or there's that thing I've had a sense that is really needing my attention. But it also might be something that's like a little bit more of a shadow in the background, or maybe like a stirring in your belly. And so as I'm talking, you can reflect and notice, huh, what's life calling me to? You know, what is it that's arising in me that's calling for my attention within or outside of me? You know, for the Buddha, the quite famous story of maybe the most dramatic call for him, it came in the form of an encounter with sickness, old age, and death. And if you don't know the story, essentially the Buddha, the man that was the Buddha, he was raised in seclusion, his own form of social distancing. He was distanced from much of the reality of the world, raised within very luxurious palaces and completely guarded against any kind of suffering. Until one day he had this impulse. Something arose in him that said, I want to go beyond the palace walls. Now, that might not be a rational impulse. He had all the luxury, everything that he could want, but there was something deeper that called to him. And so he went outside of the palace walls secretly, and he came across someone who was sick, someone who was aged, and a corpse, someone who had died. And this was incredibly impactful for him, seeing each of these three things, really symbols of tremendous suffering, the suffering that happens in life. And when he saw that, his world as he knew it was shattered. And he knew that there was something that he needed that he didn't have, an awakening, insight into the nature, the true nature of life, of how to be with this encounter that he'd had. So that was at least one of the Buddha's great calls. And maybe, you know, for you, it's been like that. Maybe it's been an encounter with suffering. Maybe it's been an encounter with aging, of sickness and death. You know, I know for myself, as I approach 50, that I feel that more. My parents are entering, both of them are entering their 80th birthdays this year. And so there is that reality of mortality. But it could also come as a health issue, regardless of your age. You know, like I said, it could be a challenge in a relationship with a child or a coworker. You know, for you moms, it's like, yeah, there's plenty of challenges. It can also come as a desire. And this is really important. You know, I would say this is my preferred form, though we know it's not always easy, because desires can be really confronting. And we're going to talk about that. But really, you know, as they say in 12-step, things can come from inspiration or desperation. Sometimes we get to choose, sometimes we don't, but the call can come either way. So noticing, yeah, what are the calls in your life? Now, you might have identified a call, you know, as we're talking, or you might be very well aware of the different calls in your life. But naturally, just because we hear a call, even if we're able to tune in and sense something at a very subtle level, you know, in our intuition, in our sensation, in our environment, it doesn't always mean that we respond to it, right? In fact, there's hearing the call, and then there's moving into action around it. Like, for instance, I heard that call of spring, and then at the same time, I could feel all of the stagnation, the reservation, the analysis paralysis, like, oh, what is it to do? Which fitness studio should I go to? What's really needed here? And the like, oh, do I really want to get up off of this sofa? It is so comfortable. That sofa right there. I spent a lot of time there during the pandemic. So yeah, you know, and your own version of this is quite a light example, but we have our own version of this stagnation, reservation, the analysis paralysis that gets revealed when we're called to action. you know, in the hero's journey, you know, the mythic mapping of the hero's journey, there's a whole stage called refusal of the call. And most often this is before the hero meets their mentor, a mentor that will help them cross the threshold. But there is this whole experience where the call comes up and the hero says, hell no. I'm not sure about this. I don't know how I'm going to do this. That's scary. That's unfamiliar. And of course, because of my aversive tendencies, and you know, probably you have your own, I'm an expert in the refusal of the call. I know what it's like to feel a call, and even the torture of really being able to hear subtle calls and to refuse them. And also, I see this all the time with people that I work with. You know, it's really a universal human pattern. That's why it's in things like the hero's journey, is that there are countless creative ways to refuse a call. I've seen pretty much all of them. And the Buddha had them too. This is really important to recognize. It's not like the Buddha was just born and he was awake and it was all easy for him. You know, in his story, if you actually really follow the story of any great spiritual teacher, there are these experiences of the confrontation with the call, the needing to navigate response. So in the case of the Buddha, there's some different stories about that day when he left the palace and he had his encounter with the call of suffering. And one of the stories is that night he said, okay, I hear the call. I need to leave this life. I need to go on my journey. But that he passes by his wife's bedroom and seeing her, it's like, oh, wait, she's so beautiful. There she is. She's lying in bed. And so he goes in and he has sex. They have sex and they conceive their only child. So that's the first story. In other versions, because of course in these mythic tales, there's all kinds of versions. On the day that he's leaving is the same day she actually gives birth to the child, the son. And, you know, in these versions, it's sometimes said that his wife begs him, says like, no, don't go, take me with you. You know, like, of course, you could imagine the tension. You know, either she's just conceived or they've had this incredible intimacy, or she's just given birth to a child and her husband, the father, is saying, yeah, I gotta go. And so, you know, not a saintly position to be in, to be in this tension. Later, you know, 6 years later, he is coming to the culmination of his journey, and he's sitting under the Bodhi tree. And you might have heard the story of his resolution to sit until awakening. And as he's sitting, the demon, the mythological demon Mara, and all of Mara's armies, daughters, everyone comes along for the ride. Really, Mara is the personification of the Buddha's own mental conditioning, of all of our mental conditioning. The Buddha's sitting there, and Mara comes along and starts taunting him. In fact, he has his army shower the Buddha with arrows. And all of these arrows start coming towards the Buddha as he's sitting there. Really arrows that represent these habits of mind, the neuroses. You know, for many of us, it could be traumas that create certain patterns or reactions inside of us. But, you know, however you see them, they're the things that can prevent us from responding, from seeing through the call. You know, in his case, it was the call to awaken, to claim his awakening. And there's the whole process of how the Buddha responds to that. But you can see, you know, to get to the appropriate response, to learn how to face the call and to respond, we have to be able to see what inhibits us from doing that. You know, we have to be able to see, Buddha had to sit there and see these arrows coming towards them. He couldn't just ignore them. You know, he couldn't just pretend that they weren't there. He had to see them. So we have to see what arrows come towards us, what actually inhibits us from being able to respond, because our responsiveness is dependent on that. You know, we have to be able to navigate our psyches. And again, you know, I was saying before, maybe you're thinking about your own calls in life, and you might also start thinking about like, what are the arrows that come my way? You know, what inhibits me from being able to respond? And maybe if you think of even one particular circumstance, and what are some of the patterns of mind that are preventing response for you? And maybe I'm going to talk a little bit about this so you can kind of see what they might look like, you know, in this modern age. What do those arrows, what do Mara's arrows look like? In the form of aversion, you know, the one that I know best, it can really take on 100 different forms of fear. Recently, I was giving a talk to first-year psychiatry students at UCLA. And it's really sweet because they're quite young, the students. And one of them really earnestly asked, you know, in the topic of sexuality and intimacy, like, wow, if I really start engaging in intimacy, if I really start being open to this, how can I be sure that I never hurt anybody? How can I be sure I never hurt anyone? And you can really feel the tenderness of that question, right? The fear of like, oh my gosh, if I open to life, if I open to intimacy, people might get hurt. And I let them know, you know, you're going to hurt people. That is part of intimacy. Is hurt is part of it. But you can also learn to do it consciously, and you can learn to do it in connection. But if you're always holding back out of fear, you always hold back from intimacy, from life, out of fear, then you're never going to get the real thing. And so, you know, it's like, oh, that willingness to know, like, things are going to happen. The Buddha did leave his wife, either on the night she conceived or the day she gave birth. It's not like there is an absence of hurt on this path. You know, you might have heard of this concept. It's called the bliss of blamelessness. And sometimes we talk about it when we talk about ethics, about knowing if we actually live ethically, that there'll be nothing we can be blamed for. You know, it's quite a high concept. But it's one to have caution with, because there's also something called the cult of innocence. And one of my teachers, Franciscan theologian Richard Rohr, talks about this, you know, this addiction to being right, to being sinless, to in some way sort of establish our superiority through being part of this cult of innocence. You know, it's like, oh, I'm none of those things. I never do any of those things. You know, I'm beyond that. You know, really, this can be a fear response. It's like wanting to be perfect. You know, this perfectionism, wanting to be perfect, and that kind of addiction to that perfection, like I said, you know, whether it's with intimacy, whether it's in responding to family, to a need in the world, when we're trying to get it perfect, when we're trying to be, you know, absolutely blameless, we can lose our connection to our responsiveness. You know, certainly if the Buddha had waited to be perfect, he likely would never have gone on his journey. And certainly if he had been aspiring to be above everything, beyond everything, he wouldn't have had the capacity to actually face what was there, the real habits of mind that were there. Another story of the Buddha is about how the fear of not fitting in can actually prevent our responsiveness. And I see this a lot. You know, it's that deeply human desire to want to belong, to want to fit in. For the Buddha, you know, before he sat down under the Bodhi tree, he was wandering around and he was practicing with these five other ascetics. And they were renouncing things pretty much left, right, and center, like everything that they could. They were renouncing, essentially starving themselves to death. I kind of think the Buddha was an aversive type. He was really like, not that on his journey. But then what happened is this really beautiful young milkmaid came along, Sujata, and she had this bowl of rice milk. She was actually going to make an offering to a spirit. And instead she saw him and she saw him starving. And she said, like, here, take this rice milk. But he hesitated because here he was with his gang, like his, you know, the five gang of the ascetics hanging out together, doing their thing. And to take this would to somehow be breaking his belonging to, like, his being part of something, his doing the right thing according to this group. But then he knew, oh yeah, here's life arising. It's right for me to take this bowl of rice milk. So he took it and he nourished himself. And in nourishing himself, he had enough strength to sit under the Bodhi tree and to stay there until his awakening. And then that's really what led to the development of the middle way. So, you know, you can just get a sense here. There's many ways in which fear blocks us. That's why I encourage all of my students to engage in a regular inquiry into fear. I'll talk about that in a bit. But, you know, really, it's like if we don't know our fear, we're not going to know when the call comes. And if we know our fear, then we can hear the call and we can accept the rice porridge, you know, the rice porridge of life. So let's see, I'm aware of time, so I'm going to go a little bit quicker here, but you know, we also have delusion. You know, when there is a blocking of natural energy, of the natural responsiveness that wants to rise up through us for whatever reason, all of that energy gets stuck in our body and our mind. That's when the Buddha talked about papancha, how our mind starts perseverating. We fall into analysis paralysis. It's like the thinking that goes everywhere but goes nowhere, right? And we fog ourselves. This is when we get on the internet and try to research. I need to figure out everything. What's the right answer? We fall into delusion, into this fog. Or we can fall into greed, and that prevents us. You know, I talked a little bit about that state addiction. That when we find something that's familiar, the stable ground, you know, even if as confining as it can be, like it was during the pandemic, that homeostasis, it's still familiar and we can want to fall asleep. There's the story from the Vimalakirti Sutras where they talk about these devas, these celestial beings that seem to just live the most blissful life. All they do all day long is smell flowers and they live in this kind of perfume bliss. But the Buddha says, like, the truth is they can't wake up because they have it too good. There's no sand in the pearl, you know, waking them up towards awakening. And that's kind of what can happen to us, you know, whether it seems like everything smells so good or it's just so comfortable. And certainly, you know, I see this a lot with people that I work with, you know, whether they're single and they've been celibate for many years and they can feel the call of intimacy, but it's like, oh, this is familiar. I just know this. It's more comfortable. Or they've been married for many years and like a new aspect of their psyche arises, maybe a certain aspect of their sexuality they've never understood or included or explored. And so this requires us to look at, oh, where have we had a preference for how things are? Or maybe even a preference for a certain aspect of ourselves, you know, like the spiritual part. I really prefer the reliable part of myself or the stable part of myself. And so then we go and we cut off the wisdom of other parts. You know, this is often where sex gets tossed in the bin. Like, oh, you know, I'd rather have it be, you know, more of this really stable part, and that stirs up too much, you know, creativity, life force. These are very things that can cut us off from that life force. So, you know, reflect on which of those actually are like, yeah, I can see that pattern in myself. ultimately with all of them, there is a resistance to being with discomfort, because responsiveness often means discomfort, feeling the sensation. And there's a lot that we'll do to evade that, to get away from it. And as we try to get away from it, it's really natural to want to go towards some formulas, you know, to say like, okay, how do I face these things? Let me try to find some formulas. And like I was saying, you know, the Buddha has plenty of them. You know, in life, we have plenty of formulas. We might feel like, wow, conflict arises. And it's like, what can I call in? Okay, I have my nonviolent communication. Or in sex, it's like, things are not going well. Let me try a new technique or a new toy. You know, there's really endless options for all of this kind of thing. And you can think of all the silver bullets that you've tried in order to handle life, in order to handle the call of life. Or maybe you've had them tried on you. That's actually often more painful when someone's been trying the formula on you. I on the Sangha Live website, I posted a blog this week. Maybe you saw it. But I talk about this example from the Netflix show Sex Education, where this young man is having his first sexual experience and he's terrified. He doesn't know what to do. Nobody knows he's a virgin. And so he goes and he starts reading all his mom. His mom's a sex therapist. He starts reading all her books and learning some techniques. So he goes into this experience and he starts touching his girlfriend, like touching her vagina as if it's the dial of a clock. It's a technique he learned, and it was supposed to be the best technique out there. And of course, it's a total disaster. You know, it's like, she's like, what are you doing? It's so unresponsive to the moment. It was so from the analytical mind, the fear mind, rather than a natural connection. And of course, it's pretty hilarious. And it's also deeply moving because, you know, we all do this. We all reach for, oh, what is the familiar response, or what's the packaged response? Or even what's the teaching we heard and how can I apply that? But no matter how brilliant a teaching is, no matter how profound, how liberating, it's not going to be appropriate all of the time. And our practice is to learn to take it in, to integrate it, and then to be able to respond more naturally, to feel in the moment what's resonant, what's appropriate. You know, this is actually what we're capable of, is this real attunement, really, to the moment of life, to another human being. And all of these techniques and formulas and things that we might learn out of fear and hesitation or uncertainty, they're like training wheels. To give us a deeper sense of the responsiveness that we have. So for instance, right now I'm learning tango, and it's a really great teacher for me. If any of you have taken partner dance, studied, if you dance partner dance, it's such a great practice. And in tango, you learn certain steps. There are certain steps to do. But if you were just to do those steps over and over in sequence, you essentially would sort of go round and round until finally, like, you just hit a wall, or you would hit other dancers on the dance floor. So you can't just learn the steps and just repeat them. You know, you just get stuck in a loop. What you have to do is you have to take all of the steps, all of the techniques, and all of the information, and then you have to let go into a flow, like an embodied response. So the Buddha, when he was sitting under the Bodhi tree, after all of those arrows and everything had come towards him, Mara's last stand said, you know, as the Buddha was basically saying, like, I'm awake, actually. I saw your arrows for what they are. I'm awake. And Mara just said, who do you think you are? Who are you to say you're awake? And in that moment, the Buddha didn't recite his list. I mean, he hadn't developed all these lists yet, but he didn't have his justifications. He didn't reach up into ideas. he reached down. He reached down and he touched the earth. You could think of this, he touched nature. And as he reached down, the earth rose up and the earth defended him and said, I am your witness. I am your witness. And of course, in that moment, Mara and his armies disappeared. They vanished. And so we can take that and we can ask ourselves, what is it like for ourselves to touch the earth, to contact our own innate embodied nature, this different kind of knowing, a different kind of responsiveness to touch that, our innate nature? And that's really the core of my teaching today, and really the core of my teaching everywhere, is touching that. Einstein is said to have said, we'll have to see if this is really true, but it's a great quote. The intuitive mind is a sacred gift, and the rational mind is a faithful servant. And we have created a society that honors the servant and has forgotten the gift. So today we're talking about remembering that gift of being able to work through these layers that prevent us from a natural responsiveness and allow that to come through. In a moment, I'm going to move to questions. And I briefly want to give you a couple of practices that you can do to touch into this. I'll start with my tango class. The very first night I entered my tango class, my teacher, Michaela, said, Justine, close your eyes. Tonight, you're just going to dance with your eyes closed. Don't watch what other people are doing. Don't look at your feet. Don't watch the steps. Just close your eyes and feel it. So that's a practice for you. You can find your own variation, but essentially it's something where you're taken out of your analytical mind, your figuring out mind, and you come down into a different way of knowing. In that case, it was being able to sense something through my body and really access it. You know, honestly, it's something often where we're a little out of control. So improv, theater is a great way of accessing that beyond the rational mind. Of course, sex naturally is a great way of accessing that, the practice of sex, of letting go. I know people talk about it in surfing or creative processes like music or art, and maybe you have others. I'd love actually if you want to put them into the chat, if you have other practices that you do that take you out of the rational mind and really help you access this different kind of responsiveness. There's another practice, and this is actually one that a teacher gave to me once. She said, when God calls, I try to pick it up on the first ring. So you can think of this. Whatever your version of God is, life, spirit, higher power, lower power, when that thing calls, I try to pick it up on the first ring. And this is really a practice of when you hear the call, what is it like to not wait, but to actually allow a natural response to come in the moment? Often we think we have a response, it comes up, and then we hold ourselves back and we think, no, wait, let me think about it. Let me work it out. Sometimes it's helpful to pause, but often that first response has a lot of wisdom and it also comes with a lot of power, a certain life force energy that arises through us. And there's something about letting it through. So looking at, oh, where in life can I allow to arise and allow it to come through? You know, we can even practice this in meditation, deeply attuning to what's there and meeting it in the moment, not delaying, not fogging over, but meeting it in the moment. And of course, meditation's a great practice. If you have a hard time hearing the call, if you feel like, I don't know if I'm hearing the call clearly, is we can start paying attention to the more subtle states in meditation. You know, often a piece of homework I give students when I first start working with them on this is to notice subtle cues in their body, like the moment thirst arises or the moment that they need to go pee. It sounds so basic, but really it's like, oh, if we could start tuning into those more of those whispers in our body before they get extreme, we can start noticing, oh, a call is arising, a call for something is arising, and can I hear it? And then of course, working with our fear and our shame. So, you know, this takes us back to the story of Buddha and the arrows of Mara. And when Buddha saw those arrows coming, he noticed them. He said, like, I see you, Mara. I know you, Mara. I know you. And we have to know our fear. We have to know our patterns. You know, and I work with a daily inquiry method to know my fear, to know these patterns of the mind. This is outside of meditation. And so if you're interested, you can reach out to me. I'm happy to share it with you. But it's very powerful for you, whatever it is that you have, to have a way of directly working with your fears. So you can say, I know you, I see you. And like the Buddha did, you can alchemize, you can change those from arrows to flowers. And of course, sometimes this all just means getting a little messy, like I said before with the student, not reckless, but being willing to take risks, to push out and to try things. Like I said, try responding, try improv, try tango with your eyes closed. You know, it's like, oh, what is it life like to set aside all of the incredibly deliberate, you know, these slow practices? And instead actually be able to allow some of the flow of life to come through us. Sometimes, let me tell you, that was not my best tango dance. Of course not. You know, and how many times do you see a surfer just get up on the wave and then get washed out? Or, you know, an artist begin and not know that this morning, actually, I saw a great quote from Picasso. And let me see if I remembered. It basically said, you don't know what you're going to paint until you start painting. It was something like that. You know, we don't know until we actually start and we allow the response to come through us. And then we find out. And then maybe the very last thing I'll say, because I know I'm going way over time here, is that we can also know that whatever our response is, there's a perfection to it. And this is not perfectionist. But this means that, you know, in this koan of the question of the appropriate response, whatever arises through us is the perfect example, demonstration of us in the moment, of our life in the moment that's called forward by life. You know, it's really like we look in the mirror. This is actually a Zen teacher, Barry McGid, talks about this. You look in the mirror, and your face is the perfect response in the mirror. It is what is. And whatever it is, it's the absolute collection of everything that's occurred up until that moment. And we can work with that. We can learn from that. So you can know whatever your response is in the koan of the appropriate response. It's the sum of life's teaching in the moment. And from there, anything we can do, we can work with. We can respond to, but we start by seeing things as they are in the moment, life as it is, and from there, response is possible. So I'm going to pause because I know I've gone quite a bit over time, and I see there's some questions, and I want to briefly mention, I'm going to take some time and do those, that life, like Marnie was saying at the very beginning, that if you have to go, thank you for joining us. Thank you for receiving this talk and exploring your own responses, your own innate responsiveness. And if you're moved, Donna is a great place to practice responsiveness, to actually feel inside of yourself right now. It's like, oh, what am I moved to do? Is there something I feel moved to give back, to contribute, to support Sangha Live and to support my teaching? And if you're moved to do that, if you feel that call, please visit the link. I think that probably it will get posted, that Marnie will post it. where you can go and, or there's actually a green button. I see it's right beneath the video that you can click on. And yeah, you know, allow that to come through you if you are so moved. And like Marnie posted, I have my website, justinedawson.com, where you're welcome to come visit me. If you have questions you want to ask in private or if you don't get to them today. Okay, so we have some questions here. And the first one that came right forward to me was, how can you know that a call is genuine? This is a really good question, right? Because it's something that first is, we know. Sometimes we have impulses inside of us that it's like, I'm not sure about that one. But, you know, or they could be based on habit, or some of our impulses are based on trauma, you know, that there were actually life force energies become trapped and there's habits of mind, you know, you could say that they come from fear or aversion, delusion, greed. And this is what I found. It's a practice of listening. So as we listen, we can tune in and start to notice. It's a practice of working with that aversion, delusion, and greed, of actually actively turning towards and getting to know it and working through the layers so that we can get beneath it to what's really there. Often actually what I find with my students and doing inquiry into those things, that as they do it, underneath often arises a great clarity of a true desire, a true inspiration or impulse that's been existing beneath the fear. And by navigating through the fear, they arrive at it. And then the other thing is that there's a certain amount of trial and error that as humans, we have to do. You know, the Buddha had that call and said, like, I'm about to ditch this palace life. Like I'm leaving something very significant to go on this journey. And certainly he had a lot of spiritual confidence. But also he didn't have, like, there was no guarantee on that journey. Certainly for 6 years, he was kind of wandering in the desert, trying all this stuff that wasn't working. And so there's an invitation I want to give you also, and that is to be willing to try things out, you know, in tango and improv and sex and any of these things. There's no one right way to do it. There is no golden bullet, but we have to be willing to try and to see, like, oh, there's that impulse. Let me follow. Okay. Now let me adjust a little bit. And that's something too, is that sometimes we think if we're going to do something, I need to make sure it's absolutely right. And I do it absolutely perfectly. And there's no mistake. But there's kind of a vulnerability to human life, to certainly to an intimate life, where there are mistakes. I mean, it's the beauty of spiritual humility, of kind of escaping the cult of innocence, that we try things, we respond to life. It's not always perfect, but we allow life energy to move through us. We clean up where there's mistakes, we adjust, but we continue to attune and we continue to respond. And in the response, we find more and more what the appropriate response is. And so thank you. That's a really great question. And then are we not hearing the call through all of our habit patterns? So, you know, clarify, please. But is that... This is actually, you know, where I rounded out this talk with the certain perfection is that, yeah, you know, the habit patterns themselves, A, can be a call when we tune into them. And B, they show us exactly where we're at. So they're a call unto themselves, you know, that it's like, oh, whatever arises has its own perfection. Even, you know, if you think of the hero's journey and the refusal of the call, even when we refuse the call, there's still a journey that happens. It's called the shadow journey in archetypal studies. And when we go on the shadow journey, often we get exactly what we need as well in a different kind of way. The truth is often it's more painful. You know, it might mean facing more of the patterns of the demons, facing more of Mara. But that shadow journey is also teaching us. And so, yeah, you know, even in our habit patterns, they can be a call in their own way. And there is something as we learn to see those, like the Buddha saw Maro's arrows and was able to transform them into flowers to navigate them, that it doesn't necessarily have to be a shadow journey. It can be a different kind of journey, a journey where life force can actually have access to us. We can open to it and it can move through us and it can power us to be incredibly responsive in the world, you know, intimately, creatively, relationally, politically. And it's helpful as we learn to work with our habit patterns, to be able to transmute some of them, integrate them, another way of saying it, so that we can open deeply to life. So I'll be a yes and to that question, and please come back and ask more if you have them. And please, you know, if you have more questions right now, please feel free to put them forward. And here's one more. Can you call out a partner that is averting life in the name of the pandemic and safety or responsibility? So let me see if I fully understand this one. Can you call out one, a partner that is averting life in the name of the pandemic and safety? Okay. So here's what I'm going to assume you're talking about, is that when we might use something as an excuse, or it seems like an excuse. And here's the truth. We might see things in other people we don't always know. And I always find it's really helpful to inquire what's happening there. Like if someone is averting, you know, let's talk for myself. If I'm averting something in the name of something else, often there's fear. There's some of those arrows, like I mentioned, there's an aversion or there's a greed or something. So it's really helpful to see that, you know, when we look at other people. This is the practice of compassion, you know, the wisdom informed practice of compassion is, what's happening that would have me do that? What's happening for someone else that they might do that? And I know for myself, rather than just trying to convince myself or punish myself because, oh, like, why am I not taking action? A more compassionate response is to understand, so that in that understanding, I have a chance to gain access to my responsiveness. So personally for myself, I find that most helpful with others too. Is to be able to see what is below, to notice what is actually motivating the action. Actions can be really disturbing, you know, our own actions and others. And as we can see what's beneath it, we can gain a lot of insight. And sometimes the appropriate response, you know, you might feel it in the moment, is to say, hey, what's happening here? Like, I notice this is happening, you know, can we talk about it? Like, or it might even be like, the truth is, if it comes to someone else and what's happening for someone else, I might have a desire for something different. I might have a desire to feel their engagement. And then it's being able to tap into that for myself and to be able to express that, you know, to really come from that very vulnerable personal place of like, I have a deep desire to feel you. I have a deep desire to be connected and to be able to put that forward. And so these are some of the different ways when, you know, we can either see someone not acting, or maybe in ourselves, we see ourselves not acting, you know, of averting things and how we can work with it. I hope that's helpful. Okay, I know we're just about at time, and I want to leave you just with a thought, a practice, a reflection. You know, today I hope you could feel this talk in some ways like the finger pointing to the moon, which really any work with a koan is. This deep question of what is an appropriate response. And not only what is an appropriate response, but like, what is a call and how do we hear it? And how do we access this innate responsiveness? It's a lifelong practice. It's ongoing. And so as you leave today, I really want to invite you to take with you inquiry into the calls that your own life is calling on you for, whether it's from people or experiences or something in or outside of yourself. And then what would your own responsiveness look like? What would it look like for you? And maybe each of us right now can even do this, you know, physically or figuratively, is to imagine reaching down and touching the earth, you know, our nature, earth full of life force, and allowing that to rise up and through us. What is it like if we open and allow life force to rise up and through us, like the Buddha did, that earth rising up and saying, I'll be your witness. So what is it like to call on that and to allow that to come through? Sometimes messy, sometimes imperfect, often very instinctual and intuitive. And in that way, allow wisdom and compassion to arise from a whole other aspect of ourselves. And see what that does with life. See that what that does with your call to life. I certainly would love to hear from you and to hear what you discover. So please feel free to reach out to me. Again, the website was posted there, justinedawson.com. And I look forward to continuing to walk with you in practice. And most likely, I will see you back here next year. So thank you all for practicing with me today. Thank you to Marnie for hosting us and looking after any difficulties as they arose, for her responsiveness. I appreciate that deeply. Blessings to you all, and blessings of touching the earth. Thank you.